Welcome, University of Chicago alumni, parents, and friends to the 2012 Chicago Harper Lecture. My name is Kathleen Abbott. I'm a 1995 grad of the college, and I'm also the president of the Alumni Club of Chicago. On behalf of the club, we want to thank you for being here tonight. The Harper Lecture Series is a key component to the tradition of lifelong learning, with faculty members traveling from campus to engage the U of C community throughout the world. And now I am pleased to introduce Tim Knowles, the John Dewey Director of the Urban Education Institute and Clinical Professor on the Committee on Education at the University of Chicago. Tim has taught in Boston and Botswana, served as the founding director of the Teach for America in New York City, acted as deputy superintendent at Boston Public Schools, and was the co-director of the Boston Annenberg Challenge, a nationally recognized effort to improve literacy instruction. He also serves as a key educational advisor to Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. And I have to say personally, as a mother of a two-year-old destined for CPS, I am very happy to welcome Tim Knowles.
Thank you.
I'm good. Good evening, everybody. Thank you very much for being here. I grew up in a village in England, a little village, and the three public services there were a pub and a church and a duck pond in that order. And I say this because we got this amazing call yesterday, which, and I had no idea what it meant. Deirdre got this call in my office that said, "We want to know if Tim would mind being backlit at the WIT." So I, of course, said, yes, I want to be this, recognizing that everything is going to go downhill for me from here on. So admittedly, I contemplated talking about all kinds of things, interesting things, this evening. Then my plans were interrupted by this. Our city struck. Seas of red shirts swept across Chicago's neighborhoods, and our broad-shouldered, politically supercharged, media-infused city had the kind of brawl that Chicago hasn't seen for 25 years. Pundits descended declaring this strike a defining moment for labor, for mayors everywhere, for President Obama. National labor leaders flew in for clandestine meetings. The New York Times ran story after front page story about the epic battle between the brash, relentless protagonists. Me, I found myself putting on makeup at odd times of day, sitting in television studios too close to people on all sides of this issue, trying to make sense of what was going on. And then, as fast as it started, it was over. The red shirts were packed up, the pundits evaporated, both sides declared victory, and as the dust settled, I wondered, was this a fight worth having? My short answer is yes. One incredibly important thing happened for children in our city. The school day was lengthened for kindergarten to eighth grade students by an hour and 15 minutes every day, and for 30 minutes for high school students every day. And the school year was lengthened by 2 weeks for everyone. This hasn't happened anywhere in urban America, let alone in an economic downturn. In one fell swoop, Chicago took on its embarrassingly abbreviated school day and school year and prevailed. In my view, whichever side of this you're on, this should give you hope. The day and the year won't get shorter in Chicago, and if we use the time well, much better things can happen for children here. But here's the thing. Labor and management agreed to the terms of the longer school day before the strike. They'd even agreed to the economics of the contract. So it seems worth asking, why did Chicago have a strike at all? Tonight, I want to try to do three things. First, talk about the root causes of the strike. Second, say something about what is at stake for children in Chicago and in urban areas across our country. And finally, talk about three areas: human capital, or people, the schoolhouse itself, and the future of organized labor that are instrumental to getting schooling right. So, the strike. The strike, in my view, was not about supersized personalities. It wasn't about bread and butter issues. And it wasn't, perhaps what it should have been, about a school system on the brink of financial collapse. The strike was about ideology, ideological battles that are raging across our country. One battle is about how much responsibility teachers should bear for alleviating poverty. On one side of the debate are advocates and educators that say, until we address the underlying causes of poverty, disadvantaged neighborhoods, joblessness, weak social services, and under-resourced schools, it's unfair, disrespectful even, to put pressure on teachers. I saw two signs during the strike that captured this view elegantly. One said, "Why are you blaming me? I didn't cause this." The other said, "Wage war on poverty, not teachers." On the other side of this ideological chasm are advocates, educators, and policymakers who believe that schools can have an enormous impact on helping children escape from poverty. They believe entrenched interests, not just labor unions, but pathologically broken public bureaucracies and 100-year-old education models are to blame for the mess we're in. They're convinced by embracing disruptive technologies of all kinds, creating competition and toughening accountability, we can get to the promised land. Like all ideological camps, the reformers' camp is a messy one. The extremists want to blow everything up today. Others are more patient, preferring tomorrow. And others want to dismantle the machinery incrementally. What they share is the view that nothing but a few chosen reforms is working. The second ideological battle embedded in the strike is an existential one for labor. Since its peak, the number of American workers in labor has dropped precipitously. This represents the change in the proportion of the American workforce who are in labor unions of all kinds over the last 50 years. If you're in the back, don't worry, you get the trajectory. This slide shows the membership of the NEA, America's largest teachers union, from 2010 projected forward through 2013. According to the NEA's analysis, their ranks will shrink by 16% in 4 years. In Chicago, the existential threat was made most vivid by the 50,000 students who did not miss a day of school during the strike, all of whom attended charter schools. Charter schools are typically not union shops. Teachers do not pay union dues. And as they grow, the influence of labor inevitably shrinks. Their increasing presence, coupled with the possibility of a large number of school closures in our city, was certainly one of the root causes to our strike. And it's safe to assume that our mayor and mayors across the country are thinking about how they can ensure how high-quality charters become a central part of the agenda at scale. In that sense, Chicago's strike may not weaken the charter movement, it may accelerate it. So the third ideological battle is an overtly political one. In some ways, what we witnessed here was a fight between traditional labor and new Democrats. Put bluntly, in the education domain, Democrats are no longer singularly in the pocket of labor or vice versa. This is new. Allegiances are shifting. An increasing number of Democrats support merit pay and charter schools and increased teacher accountability. This blurring of the political landscape is good for schooling, in my view. There's a chance, albeit a small one, that evidence, not party, will drive education policy. And that would be a breakthrough. So, regardless of where you are, on what side you're on, in terms of these ideological battles. The important thing, in my view, is this. The stakes in Chicago, and for children growing up in urban America, are extraordinarily high. Last year, our research group, the consortium, issued a report that took a 20-year look at what has worked and what has not in Chicago. While there was some good news in the report, there was also very sobering news. Here's the front page of the Chicago Sun-Times. The report shined a bright light on a harsh truth. The state of Illinois has systematically lowered the bar for proficiency, creating an illusion of student progress. And many policymakers and education leaders have declared a victory that didn't exist. A few years later, the consortium did another study, which many of you have seen because it's a crucible for us at the Urban Education Institute. The study tracked all Chicago public school students from ninth grade through college. Here's the front page of the Tribune. For those in the back, of 100 Chicago public school freshmen, 6 will get a college degree by the time they're 25. But beneath this headline was an even starker reality. If you were an African American boy, the odds that you would finish college by the age of 25 were 2.5%. Those numbers exclude students with disabilities, so more like 1 in 50 African American boys in ninth grade will have a 4-year college degree by the time they're 25. That's beyond broken. For poor children for whom education is the only viable escape hatch from poverty, we have basically welded the escape hatch shut. The question is, how do we open it? And for the rest of my talk, I want to concentrate on that. Human capital. See, I learned this at the University of Chicago. Everybody else calls them human beings or people. but I now call it human capital. I don't know what's happening to me. It's well understood, and it's undergirded by persuasive evidence that the quality of our teachers and school leaders will largely determine the success or failure of schools serving poor children. Yet our human capital systems are broken. 50% of teachers leave the profession within 5 years. Leave the profession. This isn't urban teachers, this is teachers nationally. 80% turnover in half the time in Chicago's most challenged schools is not unusual. So we have this massive churn of talent in the very schools that need to keep talent the most. In addition to the retention problem, we also have a very serious accountability problem. And I'm going to frame this as a quiz because I like to frame it as a quiz. Of 98,600 teachers in the state of Illinois, how many do you think are removed for underperformance per year? Oh, zero. This is a U of C audience. I should have guessed zero. Wow. No, not zero. The answer is 3. And this was over an 18-year period looking at every single district, FOIA-ing, for those of you who are in the media, FOIA-ing every single school district to find out exactly how many teachers are removed for underperformance every year. 3. Not 3%, 3. This set me off. I wrote an editorial, which didn't make me as many friends as it might have. But basically, I said, you can't make this a profession if you guarantee a job for life. You can't. It just won't happen. Here are the data from Chicago, looking at the distribution of all teacher evaluations for over 25,000 teachers in the year 2007. In essence, what this says is that 99.7% of teachers received satisfactory to superior ratings. of all the teachers evaluated. 99, so one-third of 1% received an unsatisfactory. And here are the data from L.A. This is from Los Angeles. The blue, if it looks blue, I don't know, the big bit on the pie chart, tells the same basic story. Los Angeles is Lake Wobegon. All teachers are above average. But here's the thing. When you look at the nearly invisible green sliver of those teachers who received unsatisfactory ratings, more than half, the red in the pie chart next door, turn out to add more value on end-of-year assessments than those teachers determined to be satisfactory. You with me? Not with me. So it turns out that little sliver is the unsatisfactory, the green sliver on the big pie chart, unsatisfactory teachers. When you go and look at how their students performed, more than half of them did better than the teachers who were evaluated as satisfactory or distinguished in the big part of the pie chart. So it turns out that little sliver we don't even get right over 50% of the time. No wonder people are skeptical. So complicating the retention and accountability problem, we also have a teacher training problem. And I'm going, because it's the evening and you've all had wine next door, going to take a risk here. Higher education produces approximately 95% of teachers for our country. And the risk is this. This is the hyperbolic statement. Higher education's grip on teacher training is not unlike a cartel. There's no accountability for the quality of the teachers they deliver. There's no external pressure to change course. There's no competition. And regulations are rigged in higher education's favor. And as a result, a very strange method for training teachers has evolved. Here it is. You get a degree, most often in education, a degree that comes without subject matter expertise, typically. You get a license based on the completion of the degree. Nobody is exited along the way. And you become a practicing teacher, and typically you receive tenure shortly thereafter, which protects you from being removed for life. Clearly, there are lots of problems with this system. At the end of the day, we've built a system that conflates teacher credentials with teacher quality. Teacher quality is defined and written into state and federal law as the accumulation of credit and years of service. The idea that teacher quality be determined based on the extent to which students learn has only very recently entered the equation. So, what might we do to improve the quality of human capital? These are just three ideas, not meant to be comprehensive. First, in my view, we need to build a much more competitive marketplace, delivering teachers and leaders to the profession. We, you, should actively support organizations that are willing to be held accountable for the people they train. There are examples in our midst. The Academy of Urban School Leadership, Teach for America, the University of Chicago's own urban education teacher education program, which trains teachers for Chicago much as doctors are trained, with intense focus on clinical preparation and results. But Chicago needs a much deeper pipeline of nonprofit organizations and higher education institutions dedicated to measuring success based on impact. Second, we need a new law. I grew up in a family that valued irony as much as love. So I would call the new law that, the No Teacher Training Institution Left Behind Act. But I'm serious. In essence, what this would do, the law would report publicly every year on every institution delivering teachers to the profession, where teachers from particular institutions teach, how long they stay, and the results they get over time. Whether Teach for America, UIC, Loyola, the University of Chicago, why does this matter? Clearly it matters for people interested in becoming teachers. They should know the best places to enroll. But more important, good public data on the quality of preparation programs would enable the places that actually hire teachers, schools, and school districts to exert control over the supply. Hiring more teachers from the places that deliver good ones, and few or none from the places that don't. Third, and perhaps most important, we need to stay focused on teacher accountability. While Chicago's new contract brings with it a new teacher evaluation, we're at the beginning of a very long journey. If we're going to get teacher accountability really right, we need to do at least two things well. First, we need to build knowledge about what teaching practices matter most. Teaching practices. One of my colleagues at UEI, Sarah Ray-Stalinga, has done some very important work in this domain, building evidence about what teachers actually do to deepen student learning. Only when teachers know what behaviors matter and get support to enact them will children learn more. If we only define teacher effectiveness in reference to results, did the test scores go up, we lose the opportunity to actually improve the profession. The second thing we need to do is listen to teachers. Personally, I'm convinced the vast majority of teachers want genuine accountability. However, completely understandably, they remain deeply skeptical about the field's ability to deliver. For decades, teachers have received ratings based on the most cursory observations in ways that don't distinguish between teachers in credible ways, using tools that don't predict whether students learn. Teacher skepticism is also fueled by legitimate debate over the extent to which we should use standardized tests to measure teacher quality. Here are questions I hear repeatedly from teachers. If two student scores in my classroom skew my results, how reliable is the measure? If I have 30% student mobility in my class in the course of the year, which students will you count to determine my rating? If I teach kindergarten or first or second or third grade or art or music or science or social studies, what will be used to determine whether my student has learned? And when New York City publishes individual teacher ratings based on value add scores and sends them to parents citywide, and the ratings include a footnote that says the results have a 50% margin of error, this is true. Is that fair? Is it productive? These kinds of questions need to be answered honestly, openly, and well. And until they are, the very people we need to embrace teacher accountability systems will hold them at arm's length. Now, here's a caveat, and a big one. Even if we dramatically improve teacher accountability and strengthen the pipeline of people coming into the profession, we have a deeper problem. Until we address the schoolhouse itself, reforms around it may not matter that much. What is the schoolhouse problem? What prompts good people to leave the profession in such large numbers? One issue is people have the same responsibilities on the first day of the job as they do on the last day of their 35th year. Not only can you teach in isolation for your entire career, it's unusual not to. This may have worked when extraordinary women and people of color had few options in the market, but it doesn't work anymore. The notion of doing the same thing year after year appeals to some exceptional people, but it drives many good people away. To crack this problem, we need to rethink the role of teacher. To create new roles for teachers as they demonstrate they're good at what they do, opportunities to lead, to innovate, to train aspiring teachers in the course of their careers, roles that don't require them leaving the classroom altogether. And at a more basic level, we need to address working conditions and incentives for teachers. One of my arguments with labor and management is they've walked away from making teaching a profession. At a rudimentary level, teachers need the same things that the rest of us have in our professional lives: phones for calling parents, laptops, desks, meeting space. But if you buy the idea that teaching is ambitious intellectual work, then teachers need other things: time to collaborate, opportunities to learn, financial incentives as they demonstrate results, whether helping students learn or supporting other teachers improve their practice. During the strike, we heard a good deal about working conditions, yet nothing substantive in the contract changed them. The bottom line is this in the schoolhouse, in my view: until we make it a much more interesting place for adults and children to work and learn, we're not going to attract or keep the talent that we need to make this go. So how might Chicago tackle the schoolhouse problem? In my view, we must continue to support new school creation, whether innovative startups born of local talent or proven national school models, creating a much more diverse portfolio of schools, whether charter or magnet or neighborhood or contract, is an essential part of improving the educational ecosystem. We need many more existence proofs in our midst. And if we get more aggressive about school creation, we also need to get more serious about school accountability. The reality is, it has become completely normal for urban schools to fail children. Let me say that again. The reality is, it's become completely normal for schools to fail urban children. Schools languish for 20, 30, 40 years. They wait for the occasional ambitious superintendent to come along and try to pull the plug. Why should students in those broken schools wait? Why not put all schools, charter and neighborhood, on 5-year performance contracts? Make it normal for schools to fail, to close if they fail. Not overnight, but before a generation of children pass through their doors and have their fates sealed. If we're going to get more aggressive about school accountability, then we also need to measure what we actually know matters. I'm not suggesting that we ignore standardized tests. If they're good, they are useful measures of progress over time. However, we must recognize their enormous limitations and put the real weight of our accountability system on the most important indicators: staying on track through school, completing high school, completing post-secondary school, whether college or a legitimate job training program. Those are the measures that the best social science tell us matter: education attainment, not incremental improvements on mediocre standardized test scores. But educational attainment means you live longer, you earn more, you go to prison less, you vote more, you volunteer more, you give blood more, and you have children with higher levels of educational attainment. Those are the measures instrumental to our economy, our democracy, and our social fabric. And those measures should anchor our view about how schools and the children in them perform. So before turning to you and your questions and comments, which is daunting because there's thousands of you, I want to say something about one other domain that I believe could have an enormous influence on the quality of urban schooling. Specifically, the future of organized labor, teachers' unions. As I suggested earlier, labor faces existential threats posed by a growing number of charter schools and advocates, by school closures in this and other American cities, and by increasing calls for vouchers from both sides of the aisle. In my view, to eliminate those threats, labor must shift its stance. The basic critique of labor is they resist reform. In truth, in many cases, labor's concerns are legitimate. There are many bad charter schools. The vast majority of merit pay schemes do lack merit. And most voucher systems virtually guarantee private schools will pick and choose the children they want to educate, and public schools will end up with a disproportionate number of children who come to school with the greatest need. But here's the problem. No matter how elegantly labor makes the case against these or other reforms, the message will consistently be turned against them. They are protecting their members. They're propping up a broken status quo. They're anti-reform. And that, I think, will only accelerate the existential threat that they face. So what might labor do? If I were Randy Weingarten, she's the head of the American Federation of Teachers, I would take a very, very different tack. I would invite labor leaders from across the country to my war room, or to the WIT, maybe. And I would say this. Now I'm going to try to channel her. Resisting reform won't work. We may win some battles. In Chicago, we may flex our muscles. But we'll lose the war. Even if we are right to oppose some reforms, if resisting change is what labor is perceived as standing for, we will be chipped away, inch by inch, day by day, until we lose the ground that we're standing on. Instead, and I'm continuing to channel Randy here, we must become a singular, unabashed voice for improving the teacher profession. Everyone. Not just education reformers, but parents, the public, politicians, and educators want American schools to improve. Labor should make the improvement of the teaching force its singular mission, and it should do this even if it means goring some of its own sacred cows. What might this mean? It would mean supporting the closure of schools that have failed children for generations. Resisting the closure of broken schools makes labor complicit in sealing children's fates. Like it or not, the message will be jobs over children, and labor can't win that way. It would mean supporting evaluation systems that identify and reward exemplary teachers, including evaluation systems that link teacher performance to student learning. And if the instruments for gauging teacher quality are too blunt, labor should enlist the best educators across the country to sharpen them. But decrying nascent efforts in Chicago and across the nation to fix accountability systems that everyone recognizes are broken will only strengthen the case against labor. And labor can't win that way. Further, labor should support the removal of ineffective teachers. There should be fair due process, to be sure. But protecting poor teachers is not a battle worth winning. Fighting for an accountable profession is. Labor should go further. It should advocate for a much higher bar for getting and keeping tenure. So it's not pro forma. Rather, make tenure mean something. If everyone gets tenure based on years of service and credits accumulated, labor loses. That isn't building a profession. It's protecting a job guarantee. Finally, it might even mean labor saying, "We will run charter schools." Not just one or two as a symbolic gesture as they do in New York City, but scores of them. It was iconic labor leader Al Shanker who initially endorsed the idea of charter schools, seeing them as a means to provide teachers with greater voice in the management of schools. labor should seize that mantle, prove they can generate results on their own terms at a scale that's persuasive. Yes, there are short-term costs to taking this stance. Some senior labor leaders and veteran members will resist, and the idea of job protection at all costs goes away, replaced by a more sustainable and sensible idea that good and great teachers are rewarded and chronically underperforming teachers are systematically, even enthusiastically, removed. But the long-term benefits of this stance are significant. First, labor would remain vital, not viewed as an obstacle or something to be circumvented, rather the key partner in improving American schools. Second, labor seizes the high ground, supporting evidence-based reform, not resisting it. Third, and perhaps most important of all, labor does for the education sector what it perhaps needs more than anything else. It helps make teaching a legitimate profession, not a job guarantee, but a profession that demands teaching excellence, backed by a union dedicated to self-regulation, like the bar for attorneys, or the AMA for doctors, ever vigilant about improving the quality of the workforce. And a profession that attracts and keeps more of the nation's top talent because they will do intellectually ambitious work, they will be rewarded based on what they accomplish, and because they work in places where results, born of excellent teaching, are valued above all. If labor stood for those things, they will chase away the existential threats. The union will get stronger and will very likely grow. And most important of all, children will be better served. Thank you very much.